evening, and it's nice to see everyone here again. My name's John, and I've been practicing in the tradition of Thich Nhat Hanh for around 15 years. I wonder, can I see here how many people here practice meditation? So some of us not. And is there anyone who maybe it's the first time that they've been along? Even though I've recently shaved my head, many of you have seen me before, maybe you didn't recognise me. I'm not a monk, I'm a lay person. I have a family and kids, quite a range of kids. I've got a 26-year-old son, 19-year-old daughter, who goes to uni here actually, and I've got a 6-year-old daughter and a 9-year-old son as well. So. And, you know, if you ever need anything to practice mindfulness on, it can be how you bring your children up. So it's, a lot of my practice is directed towards that, how to be patient with my kids. And I think my 19-year-old daughter is probably the one that I have to be most patient with. So I'm not sure how much awareness she has of how much effort I put in to be mindful with her. I've also been working for about 35 years, and yesterday I retired. So yesterday was my last day of work. You know, I can't say that I would never go back to work, but I'm giving it a go to retire. So. I think I was probably, I had a little bit of the flu this week, and I was probably trying very hard to get myself across the line for yesterday, and it was quite an emotional day. You know, when you leave work, people say very nice things about you, and you know, you have a presentation, you make a talk, and all these things, but all people come up and thank you for working with them and what have you. So it's a very emotional day, and I think it just all caught up with me today, because I really spent the whole day in bed with the flu, and so I've taken some drugs so that I've hopefully got it under cold and flu under control, but you'll have to excuse me if I use my handkerchief and my nose starts running during the night. The tradition that I follow is, as Ian mentioned, is a Vietnamese Zen master by the name of Thich Nhat Hanh. And he left Vietnam in about 1966 during what the Vietnamese call the American War, and he went to the United States to try to tell them that the people of Vietnam didn't really want a war. But from that time, he wasn't allowed back in Vietnam, and only recently in 2005 went back after almost 40 years, to a teaching tour. He did a second tour in 2007, and I was fortunate enough to be on that for 3 weeks, of the, about 3 months that he was there. More recently, the nuns that in his tradition, following his visits, a lot of young Vietnamese became monastics. And following that, those visits, one of the monasteries that was in the Central Highlands of Vietnam, the monks and nuns were reasons that are not really clear, but were persecuted and forced out by the local authorities, but clearly with the backing of the Vietnamese government. I think there were about 400 odd monks and nuns in that monastery, and I suspect one of the fears of the government was that Thich Nhat Hanh's popularity in Vietnam was growing too quickly. So those monastics now, in a way, a lot of them are living in Thailand. Some of them have moved to the United States and France and other countries. But we were fortunate that in our tradition, where we hadn't had monks and nuns in Australia before, that that was an opportunity for a monastery to be established here. And we have some nuns, all of them who were originally Australian citizens before going to become nuns in France, where Thich Nhat Hanh is based, have now started, and just for just over a year been in Victoria, in rural Victoria. So we've gone from being, I guess, a lay community who got occasional visits for retreats and what have you from overseas monastics, to now having a very small base for monastics, and that's a new experience for us. But it's wonderful for us not to have to travel all the way, say, to France to have to go to a retreat with monastics in this tradition. And for those people who perhaps don't know much about Thich Nhat Hanh, really the essence of his teaching is living in the present moment and bringing mindfulness into your daily life. So it's not just about when you come to a talk or when you go into a Buddhist hall to sit and to meditate and to bring your mind and give attention to your body or whatever it is that you want to concentrate on, but really to try to remember during the day to come back to yourself, to stop your thinking, to stop your worrying, to stop going off into the future or thinking about the past, but coming back to the present moment. And you know, I hope that that guided meditation gave you a flavour of that. So what I'd like to do to start with here is hear a little gatha, if you like. We have what's called gathas in this tradition, which are these small verses that can remind us to come back to ourselves. For instance, when I wake up in the morning, there's a gatha that Thay has, we call Thich Nhat Hanh Thay, as teacher, has composed, and it just one, if I can remember as soon as I wake up to say that, it starts me off on a good footing for the day. So it goes something like this. Waking up this morning, I smile. 24 brand new hours ahead of me. I vow to live each moment in mindfulness. And so it's just a little poem, if you like, a little reminder to be mindful again and to start the day in that way. So we have, you know, it gives you a little bit of intention, if you like, in how you want to live your life. The intention to have a smile is nice. It's better to have a smile than to go around looking grumpy and having worries on your mind. And maybe as I have, you know, I mean, I had a lot of years before I came to this tradition, and so that's why I've got these wrinkles across here, you know, worrying too much. And when you see monks and nuns, you know, their faces are so smooth, and they've got this smile, and they're very calm and peaceful, because they're practicing all the time. And if we can get a little bit of that, then it's so, anyway, this CD comes from a retreat in 2009 that Thich Nhat Hanh led. He goes to the United States every year as well for a few months for a teaching tour. And he actually got sick and he couldn't lead the retreat. So they had the retreat anyway, and they came up with all sorts of creative things. But it's children singing a gata to a little bit of music. Now, I know this is probably going to challenge you, but what we might do is, I think they sing this through a few times. I might just write the words. I like to do something at the beginning of the class that involves everyone and brings us all together. That could be chanting, but it also could be singing. And singing can be a practice of mindfulness. We might feel self-conscious about it, but we don't need to be, because this isn't about being in the best choir there is. This is about listening, as well as listening to ourselves, listening to the group. It's about listening to children who are singing our music, because we don't want to get ahead. You know, one of the worst things that can be in a group of singing, if there's one person who's sort of louder than all the rest, or actually they're an opera singer and they're a very good singer, but they make all the rest of the people feel, gee, that person's pretty good, I think I'll just say nothing because they're doing so much. So it's about being mindful in that way, that sort of awareness. And there's a sort of trust when we all come together that we don't have to be self-conscious. And there's certainly one thing that goes with mindfulness is non-judgment. So we don't have to be judging ourselves or judging others about it. So, if you really don't feel like doing it, you know, you're not forced to either. So. I think they sing this through four or five times, this little thing. So what we might do is we'll listen to them sing it through twice, and then on the third time we can all join in. Thank you. the career that I was in was very mathematical. And you can see after 35 years that I still can't count. So it was only three times I said it through, not four, that I thought. If you have something like that that you can remember and you can carry around with you, it's very nice to go back to that during the day. And sometimes a song is a nice way to remember a kaka, to come back to. Yes, the topic this evening, are you the master of your mind? One of the things that we should be able to do if we are meditation practitioners is to be able to know how to make our mind happy, how to produce joy. If you're a good practitioner, you know how to do that. How to, and the Buddha called it how to bring in a feeling of joy. So, at any time, we might think that we have to have certain conditions to be there for us to be happy or for us to be joyful. But it may be that we already have the conditions. That they're already there for us. And again, just to repeat some of the things in the guided meditation, you know, we have eyes, but perhaps we don't appreciate that all the time. I was walking over here from where I parked my car, and I think that you're very lucky to have a university campus in the middle of the city, actually, because there's lots of wonderful places to do walking meditation, and there's trees, there's grass, there's wide avenues, of course there's tall buildings like there are in the middle of the city as well, but here is a very pleasant environment, and the conditions for our happiness are already here. But sometimes we have an idea in our head that we need certain conditions before we can be happy, and it's that idea itself that can be the one thing that prevents us from being happy, because we don't have those conditions. The other day I was walking to work and parked my car near the station, and a lady was walking with a stick. Obviously she was vision impaired, and she was standing on the corner, a very busy corner that I had to go, I didn't have to go back that way of the road, I had to go another way, but I thought, oh okay, I'm going to go and ask this lady, is she alright, because I was really worried, even when I crossed that corner in the morning, it's pretty dangerous because the cars whiz round, they come into a narrow street, but she was there sort of standing on the corner, and I went and asked her if she needed any help to cross the road, and she just said, as a matter of factly, oh yes, thank you, and then I sort of went to sort of take the hand, but in fact she took my arm, so maybe she could see a little bit, but she just very firmly just grabbed my arm here, we started to walk, and I walked her across the road, she said thank you, and then I sort of continued to walk to the station, and she was walking a bit slower with her stick, and the pavement's not very flat, and broken up where the tree roots push up the pavement, and what have you. It was very inspiring for me for the whole day that I'd actually met that lady. She didn't want to be treated any different because she really couldn't see very well. She was just getting on with her life. She didn't want to be treated special. She was very confident in the way that she took my arm. I was the one that felt unconfident being with her. When I got the next block down and there was a set of lights this time where I could cross the road, I looked back and she was just walking down, mindfully with her stick. Of course, managed to only go about half the walking pace that I was. But, you know, that was natural for her. She had the patience to do that. And, you know, I thought, wow, you know, there's somebody who doesn't have vision, and I do, and yet I take it for granted. But that person, you know, she wasn't looking for any special treatment because of her disability. In fact, it was probably natural for her just to be like that. And she was in, you know, she was obviously enjoying her walk to work as well. So sometimes we forget, you know, that we already have so many conditions to be happy. But we have ideas that no, we need this or we need that. And, you know, maybe we tend to abandon the present moment because we're walking around with that in our head, about thinking about yesterday or trying to run into the future about where we think we might find happiness. We can only get it in the future. But, in fact, it's very much available to us in the present moment. So I'd like to now just ask you to go back to your looking at your breath. Are they talking to you a little bit, and that creates you to be thinking, and maybe your thoughts are sort of, you know, thoughts can go in lots of directions, so it's just to have a few moments of listening to the bell. And we can bring our attention back to our in-breath and out-breath. And during that time, try to be so aware of our breath that there's no room really for thinking. This little period is a non-thinking zone. And let's listen to three sounds of the bell, and with each sound we can follow our in-breath and out-breath. So that's a mindfulness bell. You know, I really hope there's something useful you find from this talk tonight. But I don't want it to be an intellectual talk that we just think about and then we go away and leave. You know, I really hope that you can bring something that's practical and helpful to your own happiness, to your own well-being from this. And just practicing something like the singing in mindfulness, that's a real thing. Stopping and listening to the bell, that's a real thing. I can stop, I can rest for a while, give my mind a rest from playing things over and over in my head. And You know, that's an actual mindfulness bell, but you don't need actual mindfulness bells. There might be other things that you can pick that you can customize into your mindfulness practice during the day. Maybe it's the sound of an aeroplane going over. Every time you hear one, you might like to stop and think, okay, now I can stop. What have I been thinking of? Well, my mind's been strained on all sorts of tangents or distractions. I'll just stop and come back to myself for maybe 3 in and out breaths. Give my mind a rest. Give myself a rest. Yeah, I encourage you to come up with your own. You know, we all don't have to practice like we're exactly the same. We certainly, I don't expect you to carry a bell around the university with yourself. Probably have a security guard take you off the campus. Or certainly people would look at you strangely anyway. So the Buddha proposed many ways to produce joy and happiness in our life. And, one of those was Chinese canon on this, the strict interpretation goes something like joy and happiness born from letting go and release. Letting go is actually one of the four aspects of love that the Buddha taught. The Buddha taught that there's compassion, that there's love or loving kindness, joy, is there, and also letting go, non-attachment, not holding on. It also includes things like non-discrimination, non-judgment. So that's an aspect of it. Acceptance is also another aspect of it. But normally we might think that happiness is getting more things. You know, I'll be happy when I get fill in the blank, my degree. When I get a car, when I get enough money to travel overseas. So this runs a little bit sort of contrary to that idea, that actually happiness and joy come from letting things go. And there's one teaching of the Buddha where it's a story about the Buddha was having his disciples, and he had them, they were out walking meditation in the field, and a man came up to them, a farmer, and he was in a pretty distressed sort of state. And, he said, I've lost my cows. And he said, they've left. And, you know, I really need these cows. You know, I don't have much. I haven't seen them anywhere. You know, it's just terrible. You know, I don't know what to do. I really have to have my cows back, otherwise I you know, just to make things worse, last month the insects ate all my crops, my sesame crops, and you know, things are pretty bad for me. I think I'm going to commit suicide if I can't find my cows. And the Buddha sort of, out of compassion, said to this man, they hadn't seen the cows. So we haven't seen them. They haven't come by in this direction. Maybe if you go in that direction over there, you might find them.
very anxious. Off he went, looking for his cow. And when the farmer had left, the Buddha turned to his disciples that were with him and said, "See how lucky you are? You don't have any cows." So, I don't know if anyone in this room owns any cows. Probably not. But cows can have a symbolic meaning as well. And sometimes the cows that we have are things like our ideas of how happiness might be. And we hold on to those ideas, and this is where the teaching of the Buddha is, that happiness comes from letting go, from releasing our cows, those things that hold us in that way of thinking. There may be ideas that preventing, in fact, our happiness. And it can be helpful to re-examine your cows. Because sometimes we don't look very closely at our ideas. We just take them as being, well, that's just a fact of life. That ain't going to change. But and in fact, they may be more than ideas. We may think our ideas are so correct and we don't need to examine them. Then in fact, they're more like beliefs. We just believe that, and we never go and have another look closely and deeply. So, one thing that we all can do is to go back and have a look at our ideas. What are our ideas that we think that we have for happiness? Our notions. And to re-examine them. Maybe we could make a list of our cows. Just take the time. In Buddhist practice, in meditation, the first part is to calm our mind and our body. To be still. To really be still. To let that thinking not be there. And to have a clear mind. A bit like a glass of apple juice. Have you ever seen cloudy apple juice? It's not a really clear apple juice, but it's cloudy. You pour it in first and it becomes cloudy, but then when it sits and settles, the apple juice becomes clear. So that's the first aspect of meditation. And the second is to look deeply into things. But when our mind is still, not when we're agitated, not when anxiety or worry or doubt or restlessness, any of those things are on our mind. Because when that is the situation, we're not really the masters of our mind at all. So to sit down and deliberately think about what are the ideas that I have, and to make a list. In Buddhist literature, there is a distinction between the term joy, or it's just a word, but we're using that, and happiness. And joy is normally associated with something that there's also a sense of excitement. Happiness is more something that's long lasting, more contentment. again, to describe that difference, there's a little story about a man who's in the desert, and he's been in the desert for days, and he's extremely thirsty. He comes across an oasis, he sees it in the distance. And at the time that he sees the oasis, he feels joy. And then he walks to the oasis, finally gets there, and he gets down on his hands and knees and cups the water and drinks the water. And that's when it happens. So he's actually tasting the water and thanking his thirst. So, but both joy and happiness can also come from the aware of our body, doing the meditation, being aware, we're carrying tension in our body. Being aware of our mind. You know, how do I feel it? Is my mind happy? Am I feeling like something bad's happened to me today, so reason for complaint. I'm feeling a little bit of ill will towards someone in my mind. Be aware of what's in your mind. It's pretty hard to be master of your mind if you're not aware of what's going on in your mind. We do need to be aware. Sometimes we can walk around the whole day and we've got projects on, we've got timetables, we've got things to do, and our mind's all in that, all in our projects. Yeah, I've got to be here by this time. Thinking of that, I've got an assignment to hand in. That's my mind. Are we aware of how we are? We take 1 moment to be just aware of that mind. And the last one is being confident. Joy and happiness coming from concentration. That may be the bit we were talking about when we look deeply into our past. Okay, now I want to be aware of the time. I'm happy to leave time for questions at the end. You might leave. There's 20 minutes enough. So now I'd like to engage you all in another little mindful exercise. And this time we're going to do some movements. So is there anyone who doesn't feel they're capable of standing and doing some movements? They're pretty gentle movements. So we might just all stand.
Through these spots.
Letters from the imagine you are Karen. This long legged bird that looks the fish that stands out.
Yeah, I guess I mentioned that it just coincidentally yesterday happened to be my last day of work for retirement, and my own example there of mastering the mind, or not, as the case may be, came up in the last few weeks, because even though I've had a few periods where I finished work and took a year or two off here and there, this time, because it was the last time, it wasn't that easy. Everybody might think, oh, you know, lucky you, you're retiring, you don't have to work anymore. But that letting go of so long of my working life, and also I suppose so much of your identity is in what you do for your work, who you are. Maybe it's, you know, maybe your identity is tied up in the subject that you study. You know, well, you know, I'm a law student, or I'm a scientist, or I'm studying to be a scientist, or whatever. You know. I mean, there is some attachment to that. And, you know, for the last month before I retired, all of a sudden I started to get very apprehensive. People would ask me questions like, oh, you're retiring, you know, you're a little young to retire, aren't you? But gee, what are you going to do when you stop work? And I sort of said, don't worry, I've got things to do. I'd walk away and I'd go, oh yeah, I guess maybe, you know, or deep down maybe that question was sort of there. You know? So these are all the things that can, you know, plague any of us. A restless mind, doubt coming up. You know, and all of these things I think are somewhat connected to that idea of interbeing, about things being interconnected. You know, I found myself having my temper was shorter for that month. You know, it wasn't just the month, but it was, you know, I found myself yelling at the kids for little things, you know, and getting upset with them. And I really realised that coming up to this change was really, you know, the waters were a little bit turbulent, and it wasn't that easy to stay on the surfboard. So the practice for that, I'm not saying that it's easy to do, but what I tried to have a go at is to, first of all, to be aware that that's there in your mind, that those mind states are there, whether it's restlessness, whether it's worrying about something in the past, whether it's worrying about something in the future, whether it's chasing after something in the future, that, you know, just as soon as, the old just as soon as syndrome. Well, I don't feel real good now, but just as soon as I retire, everything will be all right. Just as soon as I get my degree, life will be better. So, you know, being aware that your mind is there is really the first part of it. And the practice of mindfulness is just to be aware. It's not necessarily to push it away and pretend it's not happening. It's not to put your head in the sand and ignore it. But it is to sort of hold it. And, you know, to be aware, the Buddha said you can hold that it's there. And you hold it maybe like a little bird that's fallen out of a nest, and you pick it up. And you don't know if that bird's injured, but it can't fly. And so you're holding it very gently. You're holding those things. You know, that is a part of us. Our thoughts of ill will, or our thoughts of doubt, our thoughts of restlessness, our attachments to things. You know, whether it's fashion or whatever it is, our attachment to things. We're always thinking about that on our mind, to be aware that we're thinking about that, that we are attached to things. So just to hold it, and then when we don't feel in our mind that it's affecting our feelings, our emotions, as it was with me, you know, I mean, I was saying I was an emotional wreck, but you know, I was much closer to yelling at my kids than I had been for that month, because those feelings were there within me. They were deep down, they were sort of out, maybe I was pushing them down, but you know, they weren't going away. It was affecting how my mind was. So, and just to hold them. But I guess that, you know, I had to keep reminding myself about and going back to what was the real reason that I wanted to retire. Because in a way, it's also very easy to stay in your job. You know, you're getting paid, pays the mortgage. There's all sorts of things that it's very easy to do that. But, you know, fundamentally as well, I knew that I think that the time had come and I was ready to sort of do something that was going to be better for me in the long run. And you know, whether it is or not, I don't know that yet. But it takes courage to let go and to release. It's a bit of a, when the changing of the guard comes like that, it takes a little bit of courage to let go. Because we want to hold on tightly to the things that we think are important. So I guess that's my example. It happened yesterday. I ended up going through it. By the time I got to about 2 days before I actually retired, which was about Tuesday, I was starting to feel more comfortable with it. And then it all happened yesterday. So there you go. Now I'm retired, and today just felt like any other day, really. No different. First day of having an annual leave or something, you know, don't feel like the time. But, I guess that is as much that I wanted to say at this stage about the practice. But, you know, maybe I haven't covered what you were wanting to hear tonight about. Mastering, are you the master of your mind? But hopefully I've given you a teaching something that you can think about and concentrate. But if you have any questions, maybe now we can have some questions. Or comments, if anyone wants to make a comment about their own practice or share something. In the guided meditation, they mentioned chrysanthemums, and there's in in meditation practice, monks might sit in either a full lotus or a half lotus position, which is the other flower they mentioned. But Thich Nhat Hanh says that that's pretty much what you're saying. That, in Plum Village, you can sit in the chrysanthemum position if you like. So there is no real position. However, you know, if you are sort of sitting with a thing that's going to make your back bad, then maybe that's not good for you. So I do think that, you know, it's worth trying to sit in a good posture. And initially, of course, you're going to not be used to that, but try and persevere a little bit to sit in a position that's going to give you longer term problems if you do a lot of sitting. You're right. It's no point in sitting in a position that's going to make you uncomfortable, because if your body's uncomfortable, then your mind won't be still, and that would be difficult to get some peace.
I believe that sometimes you try sitting so comfortably by forcing.
You know, someone like Thich Nhat Hanh would say that there is no other moment other than the present moment. But the past, and the Buddha taught that the past is already gone, the future is not here yet. So really, to be present is to be yourself. And, you know, one of the ways that I describe that is to, when you're present and you're here, you're not distracted, so you can be aware. First of all, you can be aware of what's going on both inside you and around you. And for instance, if my six-year-old daughter comes home from school and she's trying to tell me very excitedly and enthusiastically about what she's done during the day, if I'm not too interested and my mind is somewhere else, let's say the TV's on and I've sort of got half an eye on that, then I'm not being present for her, and I'm not really listening. And she is going to suffer because of that, because she's not being listened to, and I'm also making her suffer because I'm not listening to her, but I'm not hearing. I'm not there for her. So to be really there in the present moment is to be available. Thich Nhat Hanh would say to be available for life. And if you're not in the present moment, he would go so far as to say that, well, you know, are you really living? or are you not really experienced in your life? So sometimes we can go, we can go throughout the whole day and not come back to the present moment and be aware of our body. You know, our heart, for instance. If we're there for our heart, to be aware, just to spend a few moments to give a thought. There's my heart in my chest. It's beating away all day. I don't have to think about it. But when I come back and I'm there for my heart, then I have some compassion or some empathy for my heart. And I can have a better understanding of it. I know what is good for my heart when I'm thinking about my heart. Worry is not good for your heart. Being angry, not good for your heart. When you get to my age, you know that angry people die earlier. Well, I think the practice, if anger comes up, is to be aware of it first. You have to be fully aware. And then the second thing to do is to hold it.
I apologize if I've done this drawing about the mind before. this is a particular illustration of the mind. And this here is what's called our core consciousness. And it contains all the seasons: happiness, joy, compassion, love, kindness, ill will, anger, depression, anxiety, restlessness. And this is up here is our mind consciousness. So this is where we're aware. So we know anger comes up. The seed of anger has been touched. It comes up here into our mind. And you're feeling angry. Someone said something. And it upset you, it pushed your buttons. But now anger's in your mind and you can't get it out. Well, the practice is, there's also a seed of mindfulness in your mind. Bring mindfulness up, and the mindfulness takes care of that anger. So you don't say anything when anger's in your mind, because you might regret it. You don't do anything. In fact, you just hold it. Again, you just hold it. Like that. It's allowed to, as it will, go back down into the subconscious. Because if you do exercise unwholesome states of mind, like anger, it's only like exercising yourself. It makes them stronger. So if somebody makes you angry and you yell at them, then the next time that happens, you're going to be more likely to. But if you hold it, and you're aware of it, and you allow it to slowly calm down, then it weakens it. And the next time that it comes up, that anger is stronger. These are called, when these things come up, they're called mental formations. So that formation doesn't come up. And, we weren't able to do it tonight, but I always like to do walk meditation, because that's another thing we have a great opportunity to do here. I really find that if I get angry and my heart's beating fast, you can tell your body, the anger is in your body. It's not just in your mind. Your body and mind are not really separate that way. But to be able to do walking meditation, to go outside, to get away from whatever it is that's making you angry, is very cool. If you're really angry, and it's very hard for you to hold that, you feel like you're burning. I think that's what happens in your anger. You must be on fire. That's the reason. You walk normally around the anger, so you can get your first step. Maybe imagine that the earth is helping you
another time going to it, but compassion is really a cure to have compassion. Compassion is, the image is like water cooling the flames of anger. Once you've calmed down, to be able to then look into what it is that made you angry is good, but to do that concentration after the step of being aware, and not at the time when you're sort of, when you're not the master of your mind and your anger is, you know, you're really a prisoner of that. Maybe that can help. I mean, what do you think? If you're in an extreme state of euphoria, are you going to do something that's going to be detrimental to your well-being?
Yeah.
Well, maybe, yeah. So, to be aware that you're overexcited and you know, maybe you're going to do something that, you know, you might regret. You know, when we're too excited, you know, maybe we have a joke with a friend, and you know, we think it's funny, and at that time, you know, we just, in our exuberance, we say something, but you know, we hurt their feelings. So I think that can happen. Can I just mention, we have a retreat coming up at Easter, and the nuns will be coming not just from Melbourne to lead the retreat, but also there will be two nuns coming from Thailand. Thailand's very religiously open, and they accepted a lot of the monks and nuns. But of those 400 monks and nuns, they all had to leave Vietnam because they were being persecuted. The senior monks in the monasteries were taken away, the three most senior, and they haven't been heard of. But the rest of them had to basically leave the country because they were being followed. And, many of them ended up in Thailand, which is a Buddhist country, but not in the same tradition, Theravadan tradition. Thich Nhat Hanh is a Zen tradition, slightly different. But they've allowed them to establish themselves there in Thailand, spiritually. Anyway, I might send it to you. So I don't know. You may be interested. There'll also be a public talk on the 27th of April at the Buddhist Library, which is at Camperdown, which will be given by the nuns. The title of the retreat is Listen to Each Other, Be There for Each Other. So I might send it through to you by email.